Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. I hope this is a good Friday for everyone, and we are so excited to have you joining us. We're going to be talking to Jeremy DeCristo, who is unveiling his installation Document in the Hold at Siente Potencia's Africana's Gallery this evening, Friday, May 2nd at 8 o'clock. An improvised performance by electro-acousto duo Black Spirituals, also known as Marshall Trammell and Zachary James Watkins, are going to grace the opening of this exhibit. And the exhibition is also going to be accompanied by a conversation a little bit later on in the run, Friday, May 16th at 8 o'clock. DeCristo's installation Document in the Hold is a sonic, textural, visual, and sculptural engagement with the radical materiality of blackness and black music. Sounds esoteric and interesting, doesn't it? This immersive multimedia work will engage the social, psychic, and physical and spiritual weights we attach to blackness in the world. In the moment when spectacular violence and routine oppression of black peoples is abundant and systemic, DeCristo's work challenges the fantastical tendencies of documenting and categorizing black cultures and lives. Document in the Hold opposes the projection of interiority, exteriority by which blackness is identified as a threat to the massively profound ancestral reservoir of black artistry and black more than survival in the black world. Sounds really excellent. So the exhibit location is 777 O'Farrell Street in San Francisco. And again, it starts at 8 o'clock. And for information, you can call 415-323-9406. And I believe that might be Jeremy joining us so he can tell us what all of this means. Good morning, Jeremy. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well today. How are you doing, Wanda?
Oh, I'm fine. Just finished reading the description of your exhibit, and there were a lot of points where I'm sure my audience is not quite clear what it means. So why don't you tell us about Document / In the Hold. What does it mean to be a sonic, textural, visual, and cultural engagement? What does that mean?
Well, so the piece is really multimedia-centered, and I don't know if you have the, I think you have my artist statement as well. A lot of my work begins with sound, so you know, there's a lot of the impetus for the whole work comes from working with one sound piece or one set of textures, and so the inspiration for the piece, amongst other things, and I think it's in that description, is really was looking at the textural relationship, kind of the imaginative relationship between fire, on the one hand, the sound of fire, which is involved in the piece, and the sound or experience of listening to the record. And so the soundtrack that begins the piece, or that centers the piece, is derived from the synthesis of the vinyl hear stripe on the record, you know, the part before you, before or after a song ends, and from several different records, and field-recorded fire that I produced. So the sort of, the work has this very textural quality, sonically. I mean, you know, it sounds very, it feels very prickly, like fire and like vinyl, and so there's this attempt to think of that space, the warmth of the fire and the warmth of the record, as this very creative, creative moment in... or possibly creative moment for me as well as for the audience who experiences the piece.
Yeah, so what is the music and that you are composed, that you are creating to, and where were you when you started these fires? Like, put us in the place.
That's a good question. There's sort of an interesting answer. So if I could briefly provide a little bit of history of the piece,
it actually had started out
as this piece that was going to be kind of a, I would almost say like a fictional history or something like that. I don't know if anyone is familiar with, listening is familiar with the work of a Lebanese artist, Walid Red, who creates these very, he's pretty famous artist, but he creates these sort of like fictive representations of real events. So like he's Lebanese, he was displaced by the civil war in the 1980s. And so he created this, for example, one diagram of a battle that never happened. And he shows like the bullet points and things like, and traces them with sort of like a design project, a visual illustration. And so he has this sort of fictional relationship to the production of history or historical narratives. And so this fire piece was actually going to start out as Centering Fire as the audio component. It was going to be kind of about producing a fictional history of fire, so to speak, or a proposed other history of fire. So I think people tend to think of fire, you know, as this very like primal thing that was invented for warmth and cooking and things like that. But I sort of wanted to propose actually that it has been, that fire was invented as a kind of music and that potential in it had never been completely realized. And so I actually had initially had the idea of making this piece a performance. It was not going to be an installation as it stands. It was going to be me live manipulating fire through a bunch of sort of like audio filters and things and trying to find different sounds in fire. But that didn't happen for a number of reasons. I just didn't quite go down that path or feel it was as interesting. And it also, as I thought of a performance space, I was like, I don't think anyone's going to let me start a fire inside, you know, an art gallery or anything like that because of the liability and other sorts of things. Like, you know, you'd have to have a very specific space. You'd kind of have to be outside, which would make it more complicated. And so to answer your earlier question about where I recorded the fire, is actually field recorded in my backyard, which I actually do a lot of things with field recording in my music that is composed in very, like, domestic spaces or small private spaces, but sometimes the sound reference sound like they could be other things. So it's in this piece as well. I'm trying to kind of play with what I would say is the romanticism sometimes of field recordings, of recording things that are part of, you know, what we call nature, even though I've completely created the fire and it was in my small barbecue in my backyard and is recorded in two different audio channels, and so that's how the fire was recorded.
I was just thinking about fire, you know, as one of the elements. We think about earth, you can contain earth, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
And water you can contain, but you can't contain air, and you can't contain fire, you can't even see air. And fire, there's potential, and then you see it after it starts, but maybe there's fire before there's fire, so to speak. And then we think about, you know, fire as spirit, and sort of what energy is that? And I was just thinking about Brenda Hillman, who just completed her final collection of poetry. She went through all of the elements. It took 17 years. She did all of them, and fire was the last one. And then where I attend graduate school, there was a whole symposium on fire as an archetype. And so just wondering, just sort of thinking about this whole thing about fire, and then field recordings. I think about field recordings when I think about Europeans going into Africa. Sort of documenting the people and the sounds and then stealing it. And then I think about field recording called I don't know what they called it, but, you know, when they went out, these folks went out with their tape recorders into the black community and they recorded all of these wonderful musicians.
Right,
you know, they
the
were
Low
like field recording.
For example.
Yeah, the Lomax folks. Yeah, they were like, you know, sort of anthropologists.
Absolutely.
They steal these sounds, and then you see them show up, and then all of a sudden the artist hears their music on the radio, but they didn't get paid.
Yes.
So I think about subject object when I think about those things. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Absolutely. This is central to the work, and it's also central to an album I made, which is out. If people can get it at ok.bandcamp. That's OKEH. .bandcamp, and it's called Documentaries Fantasy. It engages this too, and this is where some of the idea of the let me say a piece about the fire, or let me say a piece about this, and then I'll talk about the fire because there's a relationship between them, just like you're hitting it right on the head. So one of the things that's really been a driving force And my work has been this history of documenting black people and black people as documents. And I think that's very much, those are the perfect examples. Anthropologists, really in both cases, even though the Lomaxes weren't anthropologists, but what they were doing was ethnography. You know, is,
mm-hmm.
So
yep.
The anthropologist field recording African musics and other musics, you know, in quotes, and the Lomax is recording the blues. And I think there's, you know, in the Mississippi Delta, or black incarcerated black men in particular, and, you know, what, the 30s, I guess. So one of the things my piece is interested in is the way that that form of rendering people as document produces a certain context for their work and a certain context for their lives, or their lives as documents. And I mean, I think it very much leads to this certain kind of, well, on the one hand, a romanticization of black music that I think you see in both those contexts through anthropological field recordings,
mm-hmm.
as well as this sort of idea of boxing and capturing and storing black culture in a certain kind of way that is, I think, about framing it in a certain context and limiting the fluidity and the complexity of the meanings that manifest in and throughout the music. And so one thing that I'm kind of interested in is that, what is that anthropological tendency to document black lives and document black music? I mean, I think it's integrally related. And I think in particular, one thing you bring up, and this definitely gets at the sound, is the bringing the tape recorders, right? And so I think it's, for me, one thing that's fascinating, and a lot of my dissertation research engages this, is that notion of black folks as always captured by technology, right? So in both those instances you're talking about, there's not a sense in which black people have access to the means of technology or are themselves transforming the technology, but are sort of these ready, waiting to be captured bodies and voices for technology, for tape recorders as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
And so this all move into the fire thing, is that I think this is a bigger thing. I'm not so much saying, oh, it's as simple as, oh, like, well, you know, the response is black people have access to technology and you know, we're the documenters, although that happens for sure. What I'm interested in is that gesture, when that gesture happens of recording black musicians and the technology is supposedly the tape recorder, I wonder what other kinds of technology are going on, what other kinds of technologies are available, and when we privilege a certain form of recording or representation, what other forms of representation go away and so, or are made unrecognizable. And so you bring up the fire, and I think this is really interesting because I was having a conversation with Marshall from Black Spirituals, who will be performing at the event, along with Zachary James Watkins, Marshall Trammell, and Zachary James Watkins. And Marshall made this really interesting point. He's like, you know, it's funny, you're talking a lot about technology. I kind of think of fire as a kind of technology, you know, historically. And he's like, but it's not, I don't know if we'd call it a technology, sort of, you know, like getting around this point. And I think that's really interesting, is that one of the things of the piece is that I think it is positing that fire is another kind of technology that doesn't have the same logical dimensions that things like computers do, or that, you know, tape recorders do. I think there's a really interesting, like, alternative history of tech, or kind of alternative technology via fire that the piece is trying to realize, you know, as a sort of counter to the documentation of black culture, or exclusively the documentation of black culture that was going on in those instances that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's really fascinating. Does that have anything to do with your doctoral research the School of Consciousness at
History of Consciousness, is that consciousness?
Like, what is the consciousness you're trying to, and is it subconsciousness? Is it consciousness? Like, what consciousness?
Right.
Is it the anima or animus? I mean, what are we talking about here? Is it the spirit of the soul that these ethnographers are trying to, or maybe they're not even trying to capture. It's just sort of in the way that they manipulate these energies, because fire is an energy. The soul is trapped or captured in this process. Mm-hmm. And what happens to the soul that's trapped or dislocated or dismembered by these intrusions?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's right on. And yeah, this is very much something I'm interested in. My dissertation research is right that I think you're hitting you're right on point that I think there's, or what I'm interested in rather, is in like the question of like what technology or what one seeks to document. You know, documentary can often, even in its attempts to go, okay, we're including just one part of this culture, or one part of this thing, it can have this totalizing effect where it's like, no, this is the, you know, and this was definitely the case with the Lone Axis Blues recording, where like, this is the essence of the black people, you know, and it was very much, you know, like, and you know, there were political ends to that too, like it was, you know, in some ways the Lone Axis were, you know, I mean, they were like white liberal sensibility, they were like, okay, we, you know, we want, you know, there's incarceration going on in the South of black men, and you know, they were against it, against segregation and these kind of things, even though they were also kind of weirdly profiting from it, the recordings, right? But like, I think that question about, you know, this attempt to document is like, what are the terms of documentary? And when you say something like, this is the essence of that culture, or this is the, you know, I mean, I think now it tends to be like, this is the essence of that culture and that's what's wrong with it or something. But when you say that, what other sorts of modes of being get lost? And I think spirit is one of them. I think soul, you know, might be one of them. That's something I'm also work with a bit in my work in sort of different ways. But yeah, I'm kind of interested in, and I think this might be in a more recent project description I've written because I change it a lot, but you know, different in the kind of other ways of being that I think blackness makes possible, and that you see black lives living that can't be captured in terms of, you know, in what I would say are like normative terms, you know, of representation or of social life. And so I think absolutely you're right. And I mean, I think that there are these different forms of energies, different forms of being that can't be reduced to these same like pathologies of like, oh, black life has lived at A, B, C, D, oh, these A problems, X, Y, Z affected in, you know, X, Y, Z set of ways. And so the piece is kind of, is definitely challenging that desire to frame black culture that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question. That might have been.
yeah. Well, you know, this is all, you know, we're talking about ideas here. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see how they're represented. I'm trying to buy some of your music right now so we can play a little bit. But then to see how sort of the art that accompanies the sound, that should be really interesting. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, how you frame this within a visual context, because I, right at the moment, I could definitely hear it, but I can't see it. And, and then you were talking about other ways of being, and I was wondering if you could maybe give us more detail or some examples of what do you mean by that, other ways of being, because when the ethnographer goes into a community, whether he or she calls himself that or not, they don't get the whole community unless they spend some significant time, and unless they live with the people, they really, I mean, even if you get quite a big chunk, you still don't know all of it, all of the nuances that are connected to whatever this moment is that you're taking a chunk from. Like, it's almost like a biopsy, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Yeah. And then you take this, you know, this cell mass out of the body, and then you go put it on display as if it is the body, but it's not the body. It's just, you know, part of, you know, a larger thing. And so you can never do it right because it's always out of context. Yet the people that don't know think this is it. And so there's a whole lot predicated on your representing, you know, a phenomena, you know, but in a fragmented some sort of way as a whole, and it's really wrong. Mm-hmm. So then anyone looking at it is getting the wrong sensibility right. about it. So it can never be right, which is the reason why museums are so wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you show us this? And this is just so fascinating. Just talking to you about it.
My first thing is to jump into your metaphor, which I like, is that idea of a biopsy. Is I think, you know, the other important dimension of that, right, too, in our, you know, kind of like era of biocapital and biolife and things is like, there's also, is not only an attempt to say this is the body, but what I've done is engage the notion of life, you know, which is to say, you know, the biopsy idea is like, I mean, I actually think of cancer treatment this way too, in general too, is like, you know, okay, there's a medicalized notion of life that I'm engaging when I carve up the body. Life and death, but there's so much more to life, you know, in general, than what gets called life in a biological sense or what gets called life in that anatomical sense of carving up a body. So visually, let's see, I'll jump from that to sort of say one of the things the piece does is, so visually it looks very much like, actually a bit like the flyer that I think we have circulating. It very much looks like, I think, a black box. I mean, I describe it in the project description as looking like a black box, as looking like a life-size pinhole camera, a shipping crate, a tube TV. So there's this window on the outside that provides a representation of life, to get back at this, or provides maybe the possibility of life, the flickering of life is what I call it. Mm-hmm. But what the piece is trying to do visually and sonically is not just affirm the version of life that the person walks into the gallery with, but trying to kind of complicate and produce a different notion of life. It's trying to kind of create a different notion of life on its own terms, in a certain way, when I say its own terms, I wouldn't say they're terms that just apply to the piece. I think in the spirit of the piece, I would say these are terms that apply to black culture and black life, right? That it's not just, it's not about the anthropologist going into, you know, because I mean, for example, with anthropologists, when they go into a culture, they're going to study work, for example. Like, okay, who has jobs, who doesn't, what jobs do they have? But something that, for example, they don't study, which I'm very interested in, and I don't think can be documented in the way that they would tend to do it, is play. Right, it's like, how do forms of play profoundly create forms of life? Not just like the exception to life or the thing you're doing when you're not working can be, you know, I think has a profound politics to it, a profound set of social relations to it. And so some of my, while this piece visually maybe doesn't, it gets at that a little bit. I don't think it gets at that as much as some other pieces I'm working on now, which is something I'm very interested in. But this piece will kind of, I think, I would like to think, open up the conversation for where there can be a thought about a representation of play as a new form of life, not just like one part of the life we already know, you know. I don't know if that kind of gets at what you're doing.
Yeah.
Might have been more abstract.
I see the big black box with a pinhole. It's like, so are you saying that there are these sort of structures with holes in them that we're going to be peering into and sort of looking from the outside in to to an environment? Is that what we're going to be experiencing?
Well the way the piece is that it's positioned in the gallery as well such that it's kind of an obstruction. So I want it to be this problem, so to speak. Part of it, so this also embraces a discourse on black people as problem. You know, it goes back to before Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, you know, the Negro's problem. So it to be this kind of obstruction in a certain way. And then I think the way I think about it is, and this also actually kind of relates to musical performance, especially if you perform with a computer, as I do sometimes, or that Zachary James Watkins, who will also be performing with a computer that night, does is that people tend to look at it, you know, when you're making music out of the computer or with electronics, as like, okay, some people's first response is, how does that work? And so you'll see a black box, and some people's immediate reaction will be like, okay, this is what's happening. How does that work? And so visually, it presents you with, it's a very stark representation, you know, at first sight. But then there's also the potential for the audience to look inside it, to occupy the piece, and see how it works. But one of the things I'm kind of trying to balance or toe the line of is that it's about disappointing that expectation of how it works. So it's not about them finding an ultimate answer to it. So visually, the outside is kind of stark, but the inside is actually equally kind of stark. There's these other sort of narratives going on the inside with a screen, with some text that will not give the audience an answer like, you know, this is what I see on the outside, this is how it works on the inside, kind of simple equation. So I think disturbing that tendency in the audience's thought is a kind of, has that kind of social dimension, or like I was saying with Black Life in a certain way, of disappointing that anthropological desire to look at the piece and go, okay, it's a stark, it's a black box, it's a window that I can kind of partially see in, there's light, so something is going on, something is animated. But when you go inside, it's not animated how you think. There's a, you know, that represent, it's meant to be sort of questioning, is this representation for me? What perspective does this piece imply? Like, am I meant to look at it this way, to stand here, to sit there? So there's sort of this attempt to displace the audience a bit in a certain way, visually, I guess, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just looking at the album, and it's got some really interesting titles, you know, for the different tracks. For one, okay, I was wondering, what is O, capital K-E-H, what does that mean? And then the subtitle is Africa's Monolith. And then you've got On the Invented Journey into the Woods to Discover the Blues. Another track is Formed of the Black Voice, which sounds really interesting. You've got Eric Dolphy tape, and I believe Eric Dolphy, I share a birthday with him.
cool.
Waiting, Mimicry, Self-Doubt, Africa's Monolith, which I just mentioned. Repetition over a Narrative, that sounds interesting. Archive / Death, and Versions of Self. And it says, like the black radical tradition that set sound free, this album is an experimentation with the failures of capture. So it sounds like, you know, sort of like, you know, enslaved African rebellion. Put the, you know, yeah, reinterpreted. You know what they call a remix, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, are you channeling like some of our ancestors that, some of the more famous ones that, you know, did not, they resisted in a, you know, real large way, although I'm sure everyone, as far as I'm concerned, resisted capture because it's not natural to be, to become acclimated to, you know, to being owned or enslaved or captured. And so to, even to date, you know, those of our people that are held in different forms of captivity, you know, be that behind bars or supposedly, you know, we're supposed to be free in this society, but, you know, are we really? That all sort of comes into question. Yeah, so talk about, you know, this digital album and these various tracks and what they mean. And I was thinking about, while you talk, I was going to download one and upload it, running out of time, but I can play it later on in the show. And I was looking at Forms of the Black Voice specifically, but if you had one that you thought would be better to play, I could play yours too.
I don't know. So the name, okay, I think you're like one of the first people to ask me about this. The name actually comes from, it was one of the first race record companies, or companies that have a race record, which is what they called essentially black music then, in the, you know, 20s or so. And I believe it was also the first company to record, not to record the blues, but to make a major blues recording, I guess, if that makes sense. I think Mammy Smith, who is credited with first singing the blues on record, I believe her first record, it might be the first blues record, sorry, was released by OK. So it isn't, so the name is kind of a partial and sort of obscure homage to the material history of black music, like the record in particular. And so I use a lot of records in the production of my music. And so for me, and this also kind of relates to the piece, I consider, you know, I think about the record as a very open-ended medium, even though that's kind of the opposite of what it was intended to be, you know, when it was produced. You know, and this relates to the documenting of Black cultures. It was produced, created with the thought that it was this very static object that could allow Black voices and Black bodies to be captured and reproduced at will. And you see it very much has a history, you know, in the labor, in terms of labor with the history of slavery, which it actually doesn't quite overlap with, but doesn't, it begins quite close to the at least to Reconstruction in the late 19th century. So a lot of these pieces are definitely channeling the ancestral dimensions of Black music. And then, you know, I think probably the most obvious example is the Eric Dolphy tape, which if people download the album, which is at okeh.bandcamp.com, it has a little booklet that goes along with it, a PDF that has a lot of artwork that goes with the piece that's about the theme of the music. It has other explanations too. I guess I could even just read those. So the Eric Dolphy piece, I guess there's a lot of pieces I can talk about with the album. Maybe musically the Eric Dolphy one might be interesting to folks that are, you know, musicians, is that one of the things that always amazed me about Eric Dolphy, and when you listen to him, when you read about him, is that he was able to produce so many different sounds out of instruments. And I kind of relate this to my thoughts about the record, that people didn't necessarily associate with that instrument on some level. He had a very unique sound with every instrument he played. And, you know, he's a multi-instrumentalist, which I'm unfortunately not. and so the piece was actually created as a partial homage, and it's actually all the sounds on the track, Eric Dolphy tape, are produced from a tape of Eric Dolphy and John Coltrane. And so I recorded the tape in a bunch of different ways. I sampled it. I changed the speeds. I ran it through synthesizers. I ran it through computers. And it was basically like trying to think of Eric Dolphy's music and career as like proposing a method, a very sophisticated method for making music. Not one that I would apply to everything, but that I could try to think about, get at something that he was doing, even though I don't have the musical language to quite do that. So that's how that track was composed. And it was sort of also a response to, again, that idea of like thinking of the tape as an end in and of itself, where it's like, okay, a tape is a static object. You just listen to it, you rewind it, you repeat. That's about it. You know, I was trying to think of the tape as an instrument. And so like what are the sounds I could get out of the tape? Which are both the audio that's on the tape, it's also the material sounds of the tape. So some of the drums are me hitting the tape on a desk, or me drumming on the tape, or me rewinding the tape and recording that, rewinding it in a Walkman, just that like hiss sound that you get, that sibilance that you get from rewinding a tape. So all the sounds on that are composed. It's a much more experimental track in terms of it. So that was sort of the limitations of that. It was less, it wasn't centered on like a song structure or a compositional structure other than that.
Mm-hmm. Sounds really interesting. Sounds very interesting. So lastly, just wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about some of your other work, because you mentioned that many of my projects, including my larger installations, begin with sound, and you also say that the architectures of meaning I project into my work can be quite systemic, schematic, and at times even rigid. Even the electronic music I produce and perform under the name of OK bears this mark. So, what is your instrument, and what other types of installations have you or projects have you worked on, and why this particular gallery, this gallery within itself is has brings meaning to the work. You think about Siete Potencias Africanas, like you know, and I looked at pictures, I'm like, that's a spiritual space. And then you have you know, as opening, you have the Black spirituals, and then we already talked about how and one can be divorced from spirit in the way one's, I guess, work is appropriated, you know, by these friendly-looking people coming in with this black box and this microphone. You don't know what it is. And then they take a part of your soul with them, and then you see it appearing in places, but you have no control over this, but it's you. So, you know, sort of the healing of that particular type of disruption or invasion is almost like you're being infected by the instrument, and your community it doesn't know how it's going to be impacted until much later, if ever.
By the
invader, because often these people that are coming in with their notebooks and their black boxes, and now things are a little bit more sophisticated. You might not even know what people are using to capture you know, the sounds, because it's sometimes, you know, it could be in a pen, it could be in somebody's pair of glasses. I mean, it could be so tiny, you don't know that you're being...
Well, and they don't even need a technology, right? Because, like, it's the way of viewing or the way of listening that's technological. They could just be listening to you and saying, oh, this means this, this is that. They don't know what they're doing. this culture doesn't know what they're doing about this or that.
But whenever you take something away, you know, there's harm. You know, you can remedy the harm in different kinds of ways. But when you take something, there's a deficit. You know, there's a hole. There's a space where that was when you take things away. So how do you heal that? So I was just thinking, you know, with regards to the location, you know, and I'm sure it was intentional on your part, because nothing is an accident, it seems to me, in the way you work. So talk about, you know, sort of having your exhibition in this particular space and how that whole...
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. that's a really important thing. I want to say, let me say something about the space, and then I think it'll kind of explain it. And these are mostly verbatim words from Salah, the gallerist, the owner of the gallery. So Siete Potencias Africanas Gallery, which is at 777 O'Farrell Street. That's between Larkin and Hyde, for those that are trying to find it on a map or just by driving or walking. It's, you know, it's interested in providing San Francisco artists of color with the opportunity to present their work in, you know, live and dynamic kind of urban context, you know, which is vastly eroding, as we see with all the gentrification things that are going on. So, you know, the gallery encourages risk-taking, production and performance experiments, and visually, and I think this kind of gets at your question why it works for me too. I think visually, the gallery is interested in representing non-structural, non-figurative, or even abstract experimental art. So, you know, finding a gallery for me for this piece was very important to me. You know, and it's tough because this is to really get into the dimensions of our, you know, current state of things is in art is that there aren't a lot of galleries that'll take the risk to put on something that is, you know, performance-based, that is installation-based, that is, you know, that doesn't have as much of a commodified, you know, dimension to it. Like, there's nothing for sale with this piece, you know, and I think, you know, with, like, paintings or drawings or photographs, it's a little easier to get it into gallery spaces, you know. But if you're an artist, you know, for anyone that's listening who's, you know, work is performance-based, to is, you know, music-based, sound, installation, sculpture, but maybe doesn't create, can be sold. I think this is another great gallery. This is a great gallery, especially artists of color, because that's already hard to get an installation that doesn't have something that can make lots of money, you know, that you can sell to you know, curators or whatever. It's already hard to get that for any artist, but especially for artists of color, where there just are even fewer spaces where those kind of, you know, events can happen. And so you're right. It's very much a spiritual place as well. I think Salah would say that. You know, so one of the things that was perfect about the gallery is that, you know, we connected through Marshall Trammell, who will be performing with Black Spirituals with Zachary James Watkins, and Marshall kind of, or actually Zachary gave me a contact. He said, here's one of Marshall's friends, you know, why don't you talk to Salah about this gallery he's, you know, been working on for the last few years. And, you know, we sort of hit it off, and he's very interested in any, and one thing I liked is that he gave me a lot of autonomy, which I think to me is something that is very underestimated to some extent for artists that are trying to get their work shown, is that sometimes when you do get into a certain gallery context or a certain, you know, performance context, they want you to, even if you're going to get the money or going to get the, you know, whatever, they want you to present yourself in a certain way. And I think I'm ultimately very happy with the fact that I've been able to present the work in terms that I want, which is very important for me, which kind of gets at the schematic or the controlling dimension of my work that you mentioned earlier, is that it's very important for me to control the context in which my work's presented. And I think it's so important for me, but I also think it's true of a lot of artists of color. I think we'll attest to that, because it's so often that we have our work appropriated or subsumed under something else, or novelized, you know, which I think is maybe the worst thing on some level. So Siete Potencias Africanas Gallery is a great place to you know, experiment. It allows us that autonomy to experiment and create interesting works that aren't, you know, traditionally as, you know, commodifiable or whatever, however you want to look at it, as you know, other works of art are. So I really appreciate the context, and so I don't know, I think that answers your question mostly.
Sure, yeah. And Document in the Hold, I didn't think about, you know, just the title, Document, and then In the Hold, I think about a ship, and then there are a lot of seafaring stories connected to Africans in the diaspora around our history, because most of us in the West are here because of some ship, and we were in some hold of the ship, for this really traumatic journey to these places where, you know, we built these communities, we built these societies, we made these people rich. So just your whole title, it sort of makes one think about transport and transportation and respect and disrespect, too, for that matter. You know, our ancestors, and we are people, and we weren't treated as people. We were treated as commodities, and to a certain degree, African people are still commodified quite a bit. In economic culture that sees, you know, profit over people all the time. So,
and so it also gets to the earlier point you made, which I think was the ancestral point as well, which that Document in the Hold is intentionally about that dynamic, right, is that there are these different spaces of capture of Black life historically, these different, how would we call them, I guess, like, I mean, in this work, I guess the kind of figures or, it's not the right word, it's not going to come to me probably, but different, kind of figures or emblems of capture documentation in the hold, in the hold of a ship is absolutely the reference. It's also a reference, I should say, to, you know, Frank Wilderson's memoir, and as well as contemporary writings by Fred Moten, the scholar who teaches at UC Riverside, Black Studies scholar who's doing a lot, who's very much inspired my thinking and my work. So if people have time to look up Fred Moten, I would suggest looking into his writings and things. But, you know, I think an earlier point you made, the ancestral point as well, which that would be added as well, but I also think of that notion, right, that that you were implicitly criticizing, and I'm with you on this, that there was no resistance, right? So, like, that there are these forms of capturing black bodies, and they implicitly, you know, that form of capture, if it doesn't explicitly get at it with all these, you know, historical lies, et cetera, implicitly says, oh, this was a, you know, we get this narrative over and over again with slavery, like, oh, it was, you know, it was total, and they captured people, and there was, you know, we very rarely get the stories of resistance. And so even in a place as perilous and as dangerous and as, you know, in certain ways hopeless, or what we would think of as hopeless, as in the hold, I think there's still resistance is formed. There's still language is still produced in that space. Cultural is still produced in that space. And they can't be subsumed or denied under the notion of total capture or total, you know, enslavement as it was in those instances. So the piece is definitely, you know, and this is what's interesting to me about the piece document in the hold, is that it's very much about the resistance of an object or resistance of the object, to use a term from Fred Moten, you know, and it's very much about the way what you perceive as an object and what, which is usually not something you grant humanity to, right? Or not any profound humanity, maybe just a token humanity. Mm-hmm. That thing resists in ways that maybe you never even thought. You know, you weren't even ready for them.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's when we think about, you know, sort of energy and how we don't necessarily think a lot of times that the rock has life, and that it vibrates, and that,
yes,
you know, the tree, even though it was chopped down, the trunk has life, you know, now it's a chair,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, you
yeah,
know, that
exactly.
came from something that was living, so the tree, it is vibrating, and then depending on how the life was terminated, that energy might not be, you might not sit well in that chair, you know, because
yeah.
it might have had a real traumatic ending. And that,
yeah.
that stuff goes through you as you sit there and try to create or try to do something good, let's say, maybe. It's just like when you sit in that chair, something happens, and it's like, and that's that energy.
Yes.
So everything
exactly.
has life, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, so your exhibition, it sounds like it makes us sort of contemplate the thing and the thing within
yes.
itself having rights that might be denied when we think about it as, oh, that thing is just in my service. Like, no,
okay.
it's not just in your service.
Right.
And that's why, you know, as traditional people, you know, we pour libations, you know, we ask the ancestors to be present. We thank them for
mm-hmm.
their gifts. And then, you know, once, you know, they help us resolve an issue, then we, you know, thank them and send them back where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about a play that you might know of because it was a stage reading, but now it's having its world premiere. Christina Anderson is the playwright, and the play is called Pin Man Ship, Pin Man Ship, and there's a ship in the play. And
oh, cool.
It's, yeah, and it sort of reminds me philosophically of a document in the hold.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely encourage you to check it out. It's at the Magic Theater, and it closes their season this year. It opens on Wednesday,
okay.
May 28th, but I think they have previews before then, and it extends longer than that. But I went to the stage reading, and I know Christina Anderson's work. She is phenomenal, black woman.
Good.
She's really great, and you'll be like, oh, my goodness. So I think having both of you all in the same month, both in San Francisco, is you know, sort of maybe the ancestors sort of doing a little programming.
So, yes. I think so.
Yeah. Well, gosh, it's been so wonderful having you on, and I think I might have you on again after I've actually
got a chance
to experience the work, and then we could speak about it, you know, like I've actually, you know it, you know,
yeah,
in a tangible
yeah.
way. I think that would be a great conversation and another one. So let's certainly plan on having another conversation after I get a chance to come through. And if not, hopefully before your talk on the 18th, that's going to be really exciting. Your artist talk, that's going to be great.
The 16th.
Okay, that's 16th,
yeah.
Is that
Macy's
a Friday?
It's also a Friday. I think it's a Friday. Yeah, it's a Friday. It's not this coming Friday, but the Friday after that. So the 16th. But the artist talk. So people come out to that. May 16th. I think it's going to be at 8 p.m. at the same place at CFJ Potencias Africanus Gallery.
Cool. Well, congratulations on another exhibition, and looking forward to continued conversations about your work.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Wanda. And this is a very exhilarating interview. It was. It was a great, and I hope people enjoy it, and I hope people come on down tonight. May 2nd again. I'll say obviously Friday today at 8 p.m. at Siete Potencias Africanus Gallery. That's 777 O'Farrell Street. And thank you again for having me. It was truly an honor to be on the show.
Yeah. You're welcome. And I think maybe we'll play a little bit of one of the pieces.
I think if I can recommend one, I did hear Gofi Tape, but all of them get at that. I think Africa's Monolith I really like. That's why it's the minute. It's longer. I think it's like 8 minutes. I don't know what you're. But anyone you want, I think that one's interesting to me. I think I didn't get to talk about that one, but Africa's Monolith is good.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't upload that one. So. I uploaded the Eric Dolphy because you told me that one would work. Monolith, what's that one about? I could play that later
on. That one is also about it's about this notion that, and I think we get it as, I mean, I get it, you get it from an early age in this culture too, that Africa is just this ancient place. It's only ancient. Mm. It's this monolithic idea of Africa, as if there aren't people living there now doing complicated things, And so it's very much, it also kind of relates to that notion of creating a monolithic, one-dimensional representation of Africa, which I think the field recordings you mentioned by anthropologists is another example of that, where it's not about the fact that, for example, anthropologists in the 70s recorded, 60s and 70s recording Africa overlooked the fact that Africans are recording themselves, you have them explicitly recording themselves in studios, making music. And so that's kind of one of the things the piece gets at. And it's got a sample from Miriam Makeba. It's got a take on her voice and how she, her work kind of complicates that passivity of the recorded object and things. So I think it'll be a nice track for folks to listen to. But Eric Dolphy is a possibility too. But anything, whatever you want or your listeners want, I don't want to tell you.
Okay, well I'll do that for later. Maybe I'll do that toward the end of the show. But right now I'm going to play the Eric Dolphy because you mentioned that one specifically. And if we have time before my next interview, I might play the Forms of the Black Voice just because I like the title of that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one's a nice track as well. I think that goes well with Africa's Monolith. They also use voice, and so it's more an engagement with voice. Yeah.
Okay, well I think I'll start with then Forms of the Black Voice.
Okay.
And then shift into Eric Dolphy if we have time, because my next interview is at 9 o'clock. Okay. All right, well, super. Well, thank you so much, and congratulations again, and good luck tonight. I'm going to try to come through to see the exhibition. Be really nice. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. I hope to see you there, Eric.
Okay, you take good care. Thank you so much.
You too, take care. Thank you, too. Okay.
Bye. voices. And, oh, my goodness, all of my next guests are in the studio. I'm so excited. Wow, this is going to be so exciting. We're going to be talking about a new opera. Okay. Oh, wow. Good morning to everyone. How are you?
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Wow, wow. I was just looking at, you know, sort of the lineup of all of you all joining me today. We have Shanette Fulker, who told me about the wonderful opera that's opening tonight and sort of having its world premiere. I'm so excited. Wow. Good morning, Shanette. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you this morning?
I'm good. And Shanette is performing soprano, playing the role of Fanny. And then Jeannie Poole is the arranger and the orchestrator. Good morning, Jeannie. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
And then we have Janice Rosina Perry. You are the composer, Zenobia Powell Perry's daughter, and you're also a soprano and a voice teacher. Welcome, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and this is very exciting for me.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Matthew Buckman. You're the general director of Townsend Opera that's presenting the opera?
That's correct.
Good morning. And then we have Barry L. Robinson. Oh, good morning. Barry L. Robinson, you're the baritone. You're playing the role of Jake. Good morning, Barry. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. Thank you so much for getting up early.
This is really early for our opera singers.
So this piece has such a rich history, and you know, Tawawa House, and just wondering, trying to think who do you think would be best to maybe give us the history of the work?
Well, I think Janice.
I think Jeannie and I would sort of like share that honor.
Yes.
And my mother was a composer who worked from the time she was 19 years old until she died at age 95 as a composer. And she was very much affected by what was around her. And she retired from Central State University, which is in Wilberforce, Ohio, in 1982. But she had never really, she knew that Wilberforce was named after John Wilberforce, the abolitionist, but she didn't really know that much about the history. And when she retired, she decided to investigate the history of the area. And she was so fascinated, she said, this calls not only for research, it calls for music. So basically, she became, in her retirement, both a historian, and that complemented her compositions. And she found amazing things about Wilberforce, not the least of which that it was a big stop on the Underground Railroad. She found that the very site of Wilberforce University was originally Tawawa House, which was this resort where often white slave owners would come with their black mistresses. It was the only place that they could live together openly. The help at Tawawa House was both African-American slaves and they were African-American freed people. It was a very unusual situation.
Mm, yeah, and the way that Zenobia Powell Perry gathered the story, I mean, she actually spoke to, was it her father who had been enslaved?
Her grandfather.
Her grandfather, yeah.
My great-grandfather, right.
Yeah, tell us that story. That sounded really
fascinating. He was a fascinating man because he somehow got from Arkansas, he was an escapee. He somehow got from Arkansas to the part of Oklahoma that became the site of two or three of the all-black towns. You know, that part of the West, Oklahoma and Kansas, et cetera, there were areas, there were 95 all-black towns. And my great-grandfather found his way to the area that became Boley, Oklahoma. And that was where my mother was born. That was where my grandfather, that my great-grandfather's son-in-law, who was one of the first physicians in this country, his name was C.B. Powell. He was both the doctor in Boley, and he was the mayor of Boley. And, you know, my mother suggested to me, and I think she's quite right, that her outlook on being an American, and her outlook on the way she approached life was very, very much affected by having grown up in an all-black town where people had power. They didn't have a lot of power, but they had power, and it made a difference in her outlook.
Yeah, were you raised, is this town still a black town, and were you raised
Unfortunately,
there?
Boley is dying now. I was reared in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where Mother taught for 10 years, and then Wilberforce, Ohio. We moved to Wilberforce when I was around 11, and we've been in Wilberforce from 1955 until Mother died in 2004. It affected my idea somewhat because I'm just realizing that I basically grew up in all black communities, and so I was accustomed to black people having power and making being independent and making their own decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And did you write a book?
Jeannie wrote a book. Jeannie Poole. Jeannie is my mother's music executor. She is also my mother's biographer. She did her dissertation on my mother's work and her life, and she wrote the biography of my mother. The biography that Jeannie wrote very much deals with mother's music. It's very much a music biography. And Jeannie, you might want to talk about that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a great pleasure because it started with oral history interviews I did with her in the 90s. And she told me a lot of stories about her life and career, and we started with those interviews. And then I started researching aspects of her life and places that she had been and performances she had, people with whom she was associated. So it was a wonderful conversation that went on for about 15 years.
15 years.
I'm very proud of that book. It's had wonderful reviews, and it's actually the first biography of an African-American woman composer that's been published.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big deal. There are many African-American women composers who deserve biographies, and there's a big problem in this country with getting that done.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the name of the biography?
Jeannie?
It's an American composer, Zenobia Powell Perry. It's published by Scarecrow Press.
Mm. Yeah, that's the title of it, An American Composer? The title of the book?
Right.
Okay. And
the subtitle is Gender and Race in the 20th Century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, will it be available this weekend at the theater?
No.
Oh.
I hadn't made arrangements, but people can buy it on Amazon, and there are secondhand copies available, as well as the first publication.
Mm-hmm. So did you write the libretto? When you finished the book, whose idea was it to make this, take this life and the story of Tawawa House and make it into an opera? Whose idea was that?
Oh, it's Penelope wrote the opera and the libretto. She wrote it, and it was performed in the mid-80s, and Janice was a part of that performance. She sang the role of Fanny, which Seanette is singing this weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So I spent a lot of time, I spent this last year revising the work and orchestrating it for a 30-piece orchestra, because Zenobia was at a small college with a limited instrumental program. She didn't have full orchestrations for the entire opera.
Mm-hmm.
And many pieces that she wrote for the opera were too difficult for students to perform.
Yeah. Yes, it's very important to understand that Mother wrote both the music and the libretto, the text. Jeannie certainly did some wonderful revisions and orchestration, but Mother did the original work. She was her own librettist.
Nice, nice. So Janice, since you've seen, in rehearsal, both, talk about, some of the subtleties in the different productions.
Yeah, well, the production that we did at Central State back in the 80s, and again, it's been much revised, thank goodness, but the production that we did at Central State in the 80s, we did not have the resources that are available for this production, and we did not have the talent that we had. We had some talented students, but we have real professionals who are performing this, and that makes a big difference, a very big difference.
Like Barry and Shawnette, they're really amazing, their performances in this production. And Matt Buckman has done a wonderful job of coordinating all of this. And I, Matt, am I wrong, but I think there are probably about 90 people involved in the production, from cast and crew and chorus and auxiliary personnel?
That's correct, yeah. At any given time, we've got about 40 to 45 people on stage. We've got everything going on backstage. And then we've got, you know, about 35 people in the orchestra as well. So it's a big production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If
well,
I may say a word about the music, the one of the important aspects of Tawawa House is its emphasis on spirituals. Mother did a lot of arrangements and a lot of revamping of some wonderful old spirituals. And often young African Americans, in fact Americans period, are not aware of the importance of spirituals and the importance of the musical legacy and the spiritual legacy of the spirituals. So that's an important part of Tawawa House. And as we study the spirituals, we learn so much about them, not only that they were spiritual guides for the slave population, but they were also messages. There were ways of sending secret messages. You know, when you have something like steal away to Jesus, that is, yes, stealing away to Jesus, but it's also stealing away to Canada, you know. There were a lot of hidden political messages in the spirituals, as well as their religious and spiritual essence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Barry sings Follow the Drinking Gourd, which is a song that teaches people how to identify the North Star so they could find their way to the North and to freedom.
Yeah. I was wondering, Matt, if you could talk a little bit about the collaboration for this particular work, and about your company a little bit, and then we'll talk to Shawnette, to the other
Barry.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Barry, right? About your roles and about the work itself.
Well, it's, you know, this is obviously very exciting for us. I met Jeannie through a mutual colleague at the beginning of 2013, and it was a time for us in our company where our priorities are trying to shift and, you know, find new ways to connect to a 21st century American audience. My stump speech for opera is, you know, that it's a largely European art form that we inherited into this country in the United States. And one of the reasons I think we struggle with opera audience in America is because we haven't found a way to make it really connect with American audiences. And so our goal as a company is to try to find new works or existing works that highlight the American experience, that also contain wonderful musical experiences, because that really is the heart of opera, is having an amazing musical experience. And so as our thoughts were evolving along this path, Jeannie, you know, intersected our company through a mutual colleague, and the stars aligned, and we had our first opportunity to do a uniquely American work, and I was very excited about that. So we partner in this production with the Sankofa Theater Company, who's a relatively new theater company here in Modesto that focuses on African American history, and so I thought with some of the work they had been doing, they would be a great partner in this to historically inform and perform in the work, and they've been great to work with in this, and it's been a really exciting project for us. I'm really glad that we get to present this work, which has been heavily revised, as we've discussed, and I think comes out quite well. So it's a really unique project for us and for our community, and hopefully is the beginning of a long path for our company of presenting works that really highlight the American experience and also, you know, serve to inform our community and our culture a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's really wonderful about, you know, presenting to Wawa House is that it's a folk opera that's written by, you know, a black woman. And often when one sees these particular works about black life and culture, it's not from the perspective necessarily of an insider. You know, I'm thinking about Porgy and Bess, you know, wonderful opera, but it's, you know, was written by non-African Americans. And then you think about Scott Joplin, who's wrote a lot of folk operas, and you hardly ever see any of his work. You know, Trumanisha is probably one of the more well-known, but how many companies are presenting that? Not many.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're certainly to be applauded, you and Sankova House, for doing this. So I was wondering, Shanette, if maybe you could talk a bit about your character, Fanny, and the story that she's telling. And then Barry, certainly want you to talk about Jake.
As you said, I'm playing Fanny, and her character description, she is sort of running Tawawa House. She's the head of the black staff at Tawawa House, and she is a runaway slave as well. She and her sister, Candy, ran away from their master, who is also their father, after their mother was sold. One of the characters in the story, Jinsey, says that that her mother was sold because the white mistress got jealous of the relationship that she was having with the master, and that she had fathered, you know, these two children. He had fathered these two children, and so they end up somehow at Tawawa House, and they're working on staff there, and that's where Fanny meets Jake. So if you want to take that away, Jake.
Sure. So I'm playing the role of Jake, and he was actually a runaway, and he ran away from his previous plantation life to and he was found in crossing the Ohio River, and was brought to a person by the name of Levi Coffin, and they brought him actually to Mr. Drake's house, this place which is now Tawawa House, and he is there to and he is like the person who takes care of the horses and the hunting party, in the story he falls in love with Fanny, and you know Fanny is a she's been, you know, moving from place to place. They've been looking for their mother for some time, and so he really is pursuing her and wants to marry her, but she basically gives him the cold shoulder because she, I guess, doesn't want to be attached because she really is looking for her mother. So throughout the opera, it's kind of there's this tension between the two of them, because he really is in love with her. But you know, and I feel that she loves him also, but she wants to really be there to care for her sister, and she has a lot on her plate as far as trying to find her mother.
Yeah, and I think Fanny is purposely keeping him at a distance, because I don't think that she's someone, after all the experiences she's had, who trusts easily. And because she and her sister have been moving from place to place, she hasn't really put down any roots in her new life of freedom, and she actually sings a song. Butler, she has a dialogue right before saying that she's been moving from place to place, but she's got to find a home somewhere. And then she sings a song called "I Got a Home in That Rock," which essentially says she has a spiritual home, a home in Jesus, even though she has been roaming at the core, she's got that to hold on to. And so as the opera takes place over a series of, is it about 3 or 4 years, Jeannie? Or is it a longer than
I'm not quite clear about the time.
Well, we know at least 3 years pass in the opera, and by that point, you know, I think she's been there and Jake has been there. He's been a solid presence in her life, and then she can finally trust that it's okay to return his love and to be with him, and that's not going to be yet another thing that's taken away from her.
May I just interject just one short message that Mr. Drake and Mr. Coffin are actual people. They were actually abolitionists and people who helped with the stops on the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Wanda, how did that work with regards to, you know, having, you know, people that, you know, slave masters and their enslaved mistresses, you know, sort of going on at the same time that this is also a stop on the Underground Railroad. How did that work out? What did your mother tell you?
It was very tricky. It was extremely tricky. And there was a great deal of Drake and Coffin and other people who were on the Underground Railroad were very clever people, and they managed to in terms of the way that they had places in their homes where people could hide, in terms of the way that they functioned politically, they were very smart. And I don't want to use the word tricky in a malicious sense, but they were people who learned how to manipulate, because they had to deal with slave owners, and they themselves were abolitionists, and they had to figure out how not to completely alienate slave owners so that they could get some things accomplished. I think they were very clever men.
Mm-hmm. It's a perfect place to hide a bunch of runaways. You have 200 rooms in a hotel,
mm-hmm.
and you have a staff that's every color of the rainbow people,
mm-hmm.
there. So you could say, oh, well, he's just a guest here, or he's passing through, or he works here, or something else. So you could always conceal the identity of
yeah.
the runaways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the dates for the actual place being used in this way, from what date to what date? And how many, is it known how many people of African descent passed through to freedom?
In that particular spot, about 300. It may have been more, but about 300.
Okay.
And when you're talking about dates, you're talking from the late 1840s up until the, you know, shortly before the Civil War ended.
So 1852 is the date Tawawa House was built. But the Underground Railroad activities in that area date
well,
back
before the,
at
the
least
building.
1840.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Wow. Yeah. And I was wondering,
Jeannie.
Oh,
I'm sorry. What was the date of the Tawawa House being burnt down?
It was built in 1852, Tawawa
mm-hmm.
House. And the African American University was started late in 1856.
Okay.
It's
that's an actual burning.
It was an interesting combination of historical dates. The Tawawa House was actually burned down on the same day that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated.
Oh,
so it was
yeah.
on April 15th, 1865.
Yeah.
Was there any connection?
On a broad theme, yes, specifically no. I think, you know, both the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and more than likely, though I don't know if it was ever actually confirmed, but the Tallawa House was burned down by people who I think probably disapproved of what was happening at the place. And both of those acts, I'm fairly confident, were as a result of the Civil War coming to a close unsuccessfully for the South.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I was wondering, Barry, if you could tell us about sort of how you come to this particular role, you know, as you know, man who's been trained in the classics, you know, classics with regards to, you know, opera and your voice, and this character, you know, Jake, that you you portray. I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how you come to the role and maybe give us a little bit more of the story, because I'm not sure right now if our audience is clear on what is the story of the opera.
Well, it's very, very interesting. I come to the role when I arrived in Modesto. I actually was in the business of jump in for someone. One of our colleagues was sick, and I received a call, and so I the Wednesday before rehearsal started, and so I was sent on the Thursday some music and part of the libretto, and I you know, did my reading and tried to do some research, and when I arrived and, you know, putting the pieces together, because, you know, it's one thing to sit and read like your dialogue, but then when I arrived and then and we all got together and there are physical people there, the role actually started to come to life, because there were lots of questions that I didn't have answered, and then when I got with my cast members and, you know, the team, then it, you know, just came to life. I actually, the music was very beautiful. When I sang through the music with my coach in Manhattan, you know, he mentioned several times, oh my goodness, this is such beautiful music, and you know, the dialogue, a lot of the dialogue that we went over, some of it sometimes kind of with the speech, there had been a lot of work with the dialect of the speech before the school and after the school, because before we weren't really educated slaves or educated runaways, and then after the school, then we became more educated and actually, you know, the speech starts to change. As far as the story goes, you know, it's a story of, there are a few more other characters in the who come to the actual Tallawa House in different ways. You know, there's one person who came, you know, with a steamboat steward, and there's a person who comes, and his half-brother is Mr. Drake. So he is half white, but he's at this place where, you know, he's safe because he is mixed. And if he was somewhere else, he would be in slavery. But there he is, you know, he's free to be himself. And the actual, I would say, the story of Jake is that, you know, he ran away and he came to this place, and he actually was a free man. Now, there's a lot of talk in the actual opera of people coming there and working out their freedom, either because someone brought them there and they needed to work there for 5 or so years and then they earned their freedom. And there's talk that, you know, some people, you know, with being, you know, the masters and their mistresses, bringing their children there and leaving them there to be taken care of. That way they didn't have to deal with slavery. So the, you know, the story within the story is that, you know, this place was just a pastiche of different people, places, and, you know, how people ended up getting to the actual, to Tallawa House. Tallawa Springs, you know, it was actually a resort for people to come to, because of they talk about how the waters were amazing. And even right now, modern day, I don't know if Jeannie or or Janice can talk about the area of where the school is, or even Matthew can talk about where the area of the place is. They talk about how, you know, I know that right now there is, in Cincinnati, there is now a, I think Jenny was saying, an Underground Railroad Museum or mm-hmm. something that they opened
right.
there.
Operated by the Smithsonian. Right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Barry. I was wondering if, certainly Jeannie, you can chime in, or Matthew, but I wanted to ask you, Shaunette, with regards to Fanny. The last time I saw you, Shaunette, more recently was as one of the featured soloists in Handel's Messiah, performed by the Oakland East Bay Symphony Chorus, and that was just really wonderful. And you are new to Townsend Opera. You were fabulous then, and I listened to a couple of the pieces you sent me. I can't play them because I didn't have enough time to change mm-hmm. the files into another format, but I did get a chance mm-hmm. to listen to them, and really stunning stunning work. But I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit, you're quite welcome, about your character and also, you know, sort of the whole idea of, you know, preparation for this role, and sort of the whole idea of an American classic, because I think the Negro spirituals are our classical music, you know, mm-hmm. one of perhaps others, but this particular form. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, as Barry was saying, the setting for Tallulah House, you have a disparate group of people who've all ended up there for different reasons. Some runaways, some who were freed, some people who, you know, children of slave and their masters, and they're all working together at this hotel. My character talks about Mr. Drake and the other abolitionists who are running the hotel really believe that, you know, all people should be free and should have the right to be educated. And there's a heavy presence of the church in the story. Church, different Methodists and Quakers, people whose spiritual beliefs led them to believe that slavery was wrong and that people really deserved education and a chance at life. And so I talk about the fact that there are church people that come from Cincinnati to give us reading and writing lessons, and as the owners of the hotel, as all this political upheaval is happening during the Civil War, they decide that they want to change the role of the hotel and turn it into a university for African Americans. And Jeannie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it ends up being the first historically black college founded by members of the African-American race in the country. And so you see the transition of these people who have come here, and they're in a role of servitude, even though they're now free. They're in Ohio, which is a free state. They then get to improve their minds, and they get a chance to have an education and learn math and the sciences and you know, have their minds fed as well as their souls. So you see this transition. You also see the uncertainty that they're feeling during this time. The war is going on. They're not sure what's going to happen. The people in the community are feeling resentful because this war is dragging on, and they don't think that, you know, they should have the right to have this university. There are all sorts of different things happening. But at the end of the opera, it's really an uplifting story, because you see this journey, and then at the end, you know, we sing this song that says, hold on, keep your hand on the plow, hold on, which means, you know, stay the course and we'll get there together. And then, of course, although Tawawa House itself, the edifice ends up getting burnt down, it's on those ashes is rebuilt this university, which then becomes Wilberforce University in Zinnia and is still standing today in that same location, which is pretty inspiring.
If you look at 19th century biographical dictionaries of what they would call Negro American biographical dictionaries, and you find in like every third biography, you find the statement that this person was educated at Wilberforce University in Ohio. And you find out that people who studied there became the core faculty of black universities all over the country and became major figures in education during the Reconstruction period into the first part of the 20th century.
Wow. That's really phenomenal. Oh, this has been a really wonderful conversation, and we can certainly go on and on because you know, 30 minutes is not enough time to justice to such a wonderful story. And definitely, Jeannie, why don't you give us the name of the book again so that people can find out more about Zenobia Powell Perry.
It's called American Composer Zenobia Powell Perry. Gender and Race in the 20th Century.
Excellent.
And it's published by Scarecrow.
Okay, super.
And we hope your listeners will come and see the production.
Oh,
yeah,
of course.
Friday,
of course. Yeah.
This evening at 7:30 and 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, the 4th of May.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Matthew, could you give us the details on, you know, sort of where Townsend Opera is and the website for people that might want to look it up and get the tickets in advance because we don't want you
Absolutely.
To sell.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're based in Modesto, California, so the performances will be at the really beautiful Gallo Center for the Arts in Modesto. You can find out more information about the production and about all the singers and the cast and all of that at townsendopera.com. And tickets for the show start at just $10. That's one of the great things about our company is our regular tickets just start at $10. So it's a very accessible art form for our community. So we hope you'll join us. We have a performance tonight at 7:30 and a performance on Sunday at 2 o'clock.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you all so much for joining us and looking forward to seeing and hearing the production.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having us tonight, won't we?
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to shift to Sunday after. Yeah, if that's okay.
Okay, great. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay, yeah, I want to come Sunday because I have to teach on Saturday. yeah, it might be kind of hard to get up on Saturday morning if I come tonight.
Well, we'll be looking forward to having you with us and any of your listeners who want to come. It's going to be an uplifting experience, and this version has never been performed before, so you'll be seeing a world premiere. And it's got really amazing music in it, the singers, the orchestra, the set, a great chorus, so it's going to be a really fantastic show.
Yes.
Right. Well, thank you so much, and have a great opening night, and looking forward to seeing you on Sunday at the matinee.
Thank you so much.
All right, sure.
Thank
you take good care. Thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm really, really excited about, well, I'm not going to see you, but I'm really happy that you're able to join the cast at the wonderful run at the Marin Theater Company of August Wilson's Fences through next week, May 11th, with performances Sunday, I believe, and tonight. Are you going on tonight?
No, I'm not going on tonight, but I'll be on for two shows on Sunday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m.
Right. Yeah, and you're making your Marin Theater Company debut in this production of August Wilson's Fences. And you most recently appeared in Master Harold and the Boys at the Sacramento Theater Company. You performed in A Day of Absence, Fabulation, and Crumbs from the Table of Joy at Lorraine Hansberry Theater, Superior Donuts at Theater Works, the Best of Playground Festival, and Seven Guitars at Artist Repertory Theater in Portland. Your film and television work includes appearances in Walk the Walk, Return to Electra Springs, Chasing Rodriguez, and Nash Bridges, and voiceover credits with Paramount Pictures, Pixar Animation, and Electronic Arts. So you are no stranger to August Wilson, and in your role as Gabriel, you know, Gabriel is a real central character to this work. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about the story, and then tell them about Gabriel, who is a veteran who has been injured in the war, and he's got a direct connection with heaven.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. Direct link. Well, the story Fences is based around the central character Troy Maxson, who was a prominent player in the Negro Baseball League, who was denied through racism his, and as a result of that, still has a lot of as a result of that, but his commitment to family and his code of ethics is still very well intact. He wants to do the right thing, and through a series of events that have happened throughout his life, him doing the right thing and conveying that to his family and people around him can be misconstrued, misunderstood. It's a very, very complicated, interesting story, but it's not really unfamiliar, I think, to many of us who have any type of a detailed family dynamic.
Yeah. And in this particular play is which one in August Wilson's 100-year cycle of African American history? Which I know it's set in the 1950s. Where does it come in the sequence?
Oh boy, that's a good question.
Chronologically,
this was set in 57. So I'm trying to remember how the sequence goes. I think there was
Don't stress over it.
I'm trying to sequence them and taking me right now, but I had done Seven Guitars, and I think this is the one that follows Seven Guitars, which was set in the 1940s. And Seven Guitars, this one follows, this is the one that came after that one, which is interesting to have done several of his plays and to get the sequence of them and to see the connection between all of the stories was fascinating, really, really fascinating. Mm-hmm. He was just a brilliant, brilliant playwright. The more I worked in his compositions, the more and deeper appreciation I have of him as an individual and as a creative artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about Gabriel. He seems to be the most free of all the characters. You know, Troy is still not quite from under the shadow of his father,
right,
who was a real domineering type of personality. I mean, Gabriel, you know, had the same father, of course, but
right,
his experience wasn't the same as Troy, who at a very young age ended up having to leave home because you know, of an altercation he had with his father. And and, you know, and he just doesn't, you know, he's always wrestling with death, you know, and
then
your character is chasing the hellhounds and and trying to sort of protect his brother and to a certain degree. But he seems, I don't know, Gabriel seems to be most free, and, he's a really different kind of character. Talk about him and sort of how you enter his world.
It's very, very interesting to try to enter the world of Gabriel the character, and the way that I approach it, and the way that we were directed into it, in combination with that, is that Troy's connection to death is one of he's trying to fight it. He's like, you know, I'm not going to let death get me because I'm going to build this around me, and, you know, death wants to come and get me, he's going to have to come over this fence. Whereas Gabriel suffered a major head injury while defending the country, and I think that that gave him a death experience. So he has died and come back to life. He actually mentions that in a couple of his monologues. He said, you know, I died and went to heaven. And when I went to heaven, you know, St. Peter let me see your name in the book. So, like, he knows that his brother is going to heaven when he dies. So he's basically trying to say that I don't fight off, I can chase off the hellhounds if they're trying to get you, because I'm going to see to it that you get into heaven. I've seen your name in the book. You're going to get there. So his take on it is not one of fear or reservation. He's joyous about it, and he takes pride in the fact that he's seen it. He's excited about telling his brother about it, and looking forward to the time that that comes. Not that he wants to rush his death, but that there's no need to really fear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in the way that your character is, you know, he looks, you know, he's got this really horrific scar on his
yes.
his head, and it's like, oh, that looks so painful. And they said that, you know, it wasn't just any kind of injury, that half his brain was blown away. Yet, you know,
he has a metal plate in his head now. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah. And you know, so the relationship, he's always asking his brother, are you mad at me? He always asks Troy, are you mad at me? And Troy says, no. But Troy, he doesn't smile much. You know, he's like it's almost like he's in the military. It's like, like you have to sort of squeeze a smile out of him. He's like real taciturn and stern and, you know, hard. He's real hard. And the only time you see him, you know, with a little bit of warmth is when he's hanging with his friend Bono. And so Gabriel, he's a real loner. He comes into the homestead. He used to actually live with Troy and Rose, his sister-in-law, and Corey, his nephew. But then, I don't know, maybe it was sort of the iciness. Maybe that's why he had to leave and go stay with the widow. I don't know. What's the deal with that? What is your, you know, when you're sort of creating the internal life of your character, what was the deal with that in the relationship, and why your character decides to go stay elsewhere? Why is he always asking his brother, are you mad at me?
Well, I think he sees the tension that Troy is starting to feel, and there's a tension that Troy feels for trying to provide for his family, in trying to raise his son, and his son coming of age, and that's a challenge, that whole this boy is becoming a man thing, which is which can be complicated in a father and son dynamic for some people. And also, I think that Gabriel sees himself as being a distraction as Troy tries to navigate his way through all these things. And so he actually says in his opening appearance on stage, you know, I just moved over to Miss Pearl's house to keep out from in your way. I see you wrestling with all these different issues, and I don't want to be in the way. And I think he also recalls the anger and tension that his father, he and Troy's father, exhibited in their, his, I think he basically just wants to just get out of Troy's way. He doesn't want to be a burden or distraction. And as he sees Troy piling up this tension and these issues, some of which are also extracurricular, I don't want to give away too much of it for those that haven't seen it yet, that he basically just wants to kind of stay out of the way, give Troy his room. And he says that, and that's the way that that's the way I've internalized it, and that's the way I try to convey it.
Yeah. And whenever Gabriel, you know, appears on the scene, he's like a ray of sunshine. He brings his sister-in-law flowers, roses for the rose.
Right.
He teases his older nephew, Lyons, Troy fathered with another woman when he was a teenager, and then you know, he ends up not being in his life to raise him. But Lyons, he says, you know, I love it when he says, you know, Lyons, you know, king of the jungle.
That's one of my favorite scenes in that whole show. Doing that exchange is one of my favorites in that whole play. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that too. And he just sort of lifts the oppression. It just seems like everything is so heavy, you know, with Troy. And then when Gabriel comes around, it seems like he just sort of holds the sky and lifts it up, like literally.
It is, and I think that's part of the genius of August Wilson's writing style, is that a lot of the topics and subjects that he tackles are heavy, and they're dark, and they're complex, and they can be kind of off-putting, and so I think he inserts that in order to break it, and it breaks it, gives the audience just a moment away from that, and then he's able to get back into what he's trying to say. So it's a wonderful style that he uses to break up his story and how he conveys it. And I've had the distinct pleasure of working in the production with such a talented and generous group of performers, producers, directors, creators. It's just been a wonderful experience. And I've had a great deal of joy working directly with Adrian Roberts, who is the principal performer in the role of Gabriel, and I'm understudying him, getting my chance to perform in the role. And it's just been a really, really good experience. I can't say enough about how happy I am to be a part of it.
As portraying Gabriel, who has mental illness because of this injury.
Right.
And I was wondering, mental illness is not something that we talk about that much, you know, outside of the theater, let alone having a character with mental illness, real central character with mental illness in the middle of this story at a time when some of the treatment for people with mental illness was barbaric and really inhumane. I mean, horrific.
Yeah.
People were like, put their people that might have been suffering from mental illness, you know, from birth, not let alone, you know, an injury, and just basically sort of just locked them away somewhere.
That happens to Gabriel. Yeah, that happens to Gabriel a couple of times during the course of the fight, where he's picked up for disturbing the peace and locked away. And they basically are extorting money from Troy because Gabriel has this head injury. They know that Gabriel is basically homeless, but they pick him up and get him whenever that happens. So that's exactly what you're talking about. He has this illness that has largely gone untreated, and he's basically being discarded by everybody except his family. And it's really... it is disturbing, and it's been a revelation to me. I was understudying both the roles of Bono and Gabriel, and I was thinking I'd be most likely to take the stage as Bono. So when I got the call to come in as Gabriel, that totally changed my whole preparation dynamic, and I had to draw a lot from, you know, what I've seen and what I have known and experienced firsthand. And in doing some research about people that suffer from mental illness and from a post-traumatic stress disorder and those types of things. So it's been a journey.
Yeah. And then when you think about, you know, sort of your character, Gabriel, you think about post-traumatic stress syndrome from, you know, being in the war. And then you think about post-traumatic slave syndrome, but people tell me now it's not really post, it's really active traumatic slave syndrome or active syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And when one thinks about sort of growing up in inner city, living under in a society where there's this racist paradigm, you know, but it's like within the infrastructure of our nation. If you know, people just even think about how, you know, our president and the first lady and the children have been attacked. And you know, on the Senate floor, you know, it's like, whoa, that is so disrespectful. It's like, where is this stuff coming from, and how can you do this? And this is like, you know, the first family and our chief executive officer, you know, so if that's happening on this level, then, okay, when we go into a play, and this, you know, August Wilson predates all of that, you know, sort of thinking about, wow, what a heavy load Gabriel bears, you know, because it's hard enough being a black man, you know.
Right.
And then we add to that layer, that you know, that sort of, that strata, mental illness on top of that, even though he's a veteran, you know, which means we should be praising him for, you know, giving his life or being willing to give his life for his country. But, you know, black veterans, you know, are not. And then that's something else that's raised in this play, Fences. You know, here is a veteran. He should be honored. What is, and what's happening? He's being arrested.
Right.
Multiple times.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, it's he covers so many issues over the course of this production. And you're right. It's so heavy. It's so deep. It's so complicated. There's patriotism, there's racism, there's responsibility to family, there's like loyalty, there's all these themes that are just central human themes in people's lives that August Wilson manages to touch in just about every one of his productions on some very, very deep level. And it's always refreshing and fulfilling as a performer to get this kind of work, and even more so when people recognize it. What he's actually trying to say, and that we're able to convey it. So I appreciate the fact that you see that and give attention to it, because all those things are there. That's right. This man was he went off and fought for our country, got half of his head blown off, and now people arrest him because he talks too loud? It's like, really? Is that how we want to treat this particular man? It's disconcerting. It's very disconcerting.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about a new director for this particular work, Derek Saunders. He made his Marin Theater Company debut as well with the production of Fences. And I was just wondering, in the direction, and since you know you've been in other Wilson plays prior to this one, What did he bring to the work as a director that helped you shape, you know, your Gabriel? You know, you have been preparing the Bono character, who is portrayed by Stephen Anthony Jones, really well.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, sort of, how does a director sort of help you articulate your character?
Well, it was interesting when I auditioned for the production. The first thing I noticed about Derek was that he was so young. I'm like, this is a young man that's directing this work that's set like long before he was even born. So that's the first thing. It was like, wow, that's interesting. But after having had a chance to meet him, work with him, listen to him, and observe his process, one thing that I got from him immediately is his passion for what he does. He loves what he's doing. He puts his whole heart, soul, mind, and being into his direction. And he had such a direct link to August Wilson. He was assistant director on several of his productions, knew him personally, had intimate conversations with him, shared some very personal stories about himself and August Wilson, which adds a whole other layer of creation as you're entering into a project like this. And having already in August Wilson's work, to have someone who has a direct link to him is the closest thing we can get in his absence, God bless his soul, Mr. Wilson. We have a direct link to him, and this is what I believe he may have been thinking. This is what he told me about this particular scene, this particular character. When he saw something that didn't work out, he would say this. It was just really, really wonderful for me to hear that and listen to him piece it together, and how he would work through scenes and say, this is the way I think this should go, and there's a sequence to how this movement should happen, and this is what Gabriel's trying to say. And it was just a wonderful experience. I will not forget it. Lifting and enlightening and inspirational for me. So I am just, again, I can't say enough about how honored I am to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk a little bit about your character, sister-in-law, portrayed by Margot Hall, Rose, and the
Margot,
younger nephew,
yes.
Corey, portrayed by Eddie Ray Jackson.
Yeah, Yes. I've had a chance to work with Margot on a few occasions, and she is, okay, here comes a street sweeper, so give me a moment if this makes a little too much noise. Timing is everything.
And it's interesting that the street sweepers would come by when, your character's brother and Bono, they work for the garbage company, right?
Right, right. Like, what's up, Troy? Hey, Bono! But Margot is just one of those gifted, talented performers that is so generous. As the entire cast is, but what I really appreciated coming in this week is I had a chance to perform in a couple of the student matinees, and I'll perform on Sunday. And I hadn't had a chance to, but I had done my own rehearsals. I rehearsed with one of our assistant directors on stage, but it's not like I had all the other characters there with me when I was doing my preparation. So when I got on stage, it was the first time that I was there with the other actor. And she was probably the first to just embrace, and here's how this is going to go, and if I need you to be over here, we'll get you there, and don't worry about it, just get out there and get it done. And that's the joy of working with seasoned, experienced, professional, talented, and giving performers, and everybody in the cast is that way. Every single actor in that cast has that same kind of spirit and generosity, and I appreciate it. I appreciate Margot and Andy, who is a very, very talented young performer, and Taeed, I mean the entire cast. I can't say enough about Carl and Stephen Anthony Jones, who I've had a chance to work with previously as well. It's a family affair. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to let the audience know again, we're speaking to Michael J. Asbury, who is understudying a couple of roles, and he's going on stage on Sunday, May 3rd, in the role of Gabriel. May 4th, sorry, in the role of Gabriel, and two performances, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the Marin Theater Company's production of August Wilson's Fences. And you can visit marintheater.org for tickets, and you can also call. Looking for the phone number. Here's the phone number is 415-388-5208. 415-388-5208. And there are different types of discounts. If you are a veteran, you get $5 off at all performances, which is kind of apropos more than other times for this particular production, Fences, because there's actually
right.
a veteran character role
right.
in the
right.
piece. So that's nice to know. And then there is under 30, which is really cool, $20 for all performances with a valid ID, and I think that makes things really accessible. So,
yeah,
that's
even
really
I
nice.
Even I'd be able to take advantage of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So back to your character, if you have a few more minutes, Michael, I wonder if you could talk a bit about sort of there is so much going on. I mean, there's like. August Wilson's work is so rich. I mean that there is the story, and then there is the deeper strata of the story. Like it's almost like levels of consciousness. You have the conscious level, then you go underneath that, and you see like, oh my goodness, like sort of what are we pulling on here? Sort of from the psychological and the deeper recesses of African consciousness and. Within the culture of these United States, where the characters are connected to enslavement in a real tangible way, and the civil rights movement is not there yet, your character's brother is always pushing the envelope, like, well, I am tired of being, why are black men the only ones that can unload these cans? Why can't white men
That's
do
right.
this? Why can't I drive, the garbage truck?
Yes.
So he's always pushing yes. these places, and so your character Gabriel. I want you to talk a little bit more about Gabriel, sort of the angel. That I mean, he's like a big time angel. And this horn that's on your belt that doesn't quite work in the way that one would think of the horn working, and then you think about the horn that is blown, you know, for reveille, you know, in the military, and horns is opening spaces, and yeah, just talk a little bit about sort of some of the imagery and some of the metaphors that are at play in the work.
Well, they Troy and Gabriel were born into a family of sharecroppers, you know, right after slavery. I mean, he talks about his father and how his father was not affectionate toward them. He didn't care anything about kids. All he wanted to do was get the kids walking so he could put them to work. And that all he really cared about was getting those bales of cotton to Mr. Lubin. And, you know, Troy actually says this in one of his monologues, that was the most important thing to them. So that's where Troy came from. He came out of that, and an incident forced him out of the home, and he had to make his way at, like, 14 years old. And it was a hard, you know, scrabble life. You know, he had an incident where he ended up spending some time incarcerated, and it was a very, very hard life. So he has seen how harsh it can be specifically for a black man. And as a result of that, he wants to see some changes, and one of which he forces through his job, as you had mentioned, through, you know, why all the white people driving and the color people lifting? You know, why is that? Why can't we have any color drivers? He makes that point. And Gabriel, having spent his time in the military, having suffered the injury, having had this, you know, near death, or actually, the way that I interpret is that he died and came back. He is the archangel. He believes that with every fiber of his being, this is who I am. I am Gabriel, the angel, and I am here to welcome my brother and announce his entry into the heaven. That's what I do. That's what I do. You know, me and St. Peter would sit down by the gate. We'd eat biscuits until it was time to he'd go to sleep, and I'd wake him up when it was time to open the gate for the judgment. That's my job. So that's who he is. That's what he does. And he is, for all intents and purposes, an angel in his own mind and in the lives of those around him. That is who he is. That is what he does. And that's the way I try to approach it.
Yeah. So, and a lot of times, you know, we've seen, you know, angels walking among men, right? So that's not a far-fetched idea that you know, Wilson has actually, you know, sort of written into this human story a supernatural being.
Right. Particularly considering what he's been through. I mean, you know, when people... Mm-hmm. And we have there's so much untapped potential in our mental capacity anyway that you know, we don't really understand all of the things that we are capable of in terms of our mentality. And you know, Jesus heard voices too, and so this man has heard it. He has seen it. You can't convince him otherwise, and we can't tell him that he hasn't. So he is who he is. That's right.
Yeah. And you know, and sort of like others, you know, Gabriel is persecuted. The children tease him. You know, people
right.
make up stories about him that aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
He's very misunderstood, which kind of makes sense. I mean, if he's otherworldly, then you
right.
know, of course, the world right. could misunderstand him because we are not otherworldly necessarily.
That's right. That's right. You don't get it. They don't get it, and that's what people do. You know, we tease and we insult things that we don't really understand. Clear understanding of it, and then it's oh, there's a revelation. There's a revelation.
Yeah, and so these hellhounds. I'm just thinking about, you know, we've got the hellhounds that your character is chasing away because they just want to just hang out and follow Troy, and then we've got Troy singing about Old Blue, you know, this hound dog. So we got dogs and dogs.
Yeah.
Would you talk about these hellhounds and juxtaposed against Old Blue, who even has a song?
Right. Well, Old Blue was was his dog from his childhood, and Old Blue was a kind of a blessing for Troy because he kind of brought him back to consciousness during one of the incidents, the main incident that he has with his father, and again, trying not to give away too much of it. So Old Blue gives Troy a lot of pleasure to recall and to perpetuate his memory. So Old Blue is a positive presence in the life of Troy and in the life of the family as well. It gives them a lot of joy and laughter to talk about the song and about what Old Blue did, that kind of thing. Whereas the Hellhounds are trying to, you know, snip at everybody's heels and drag people off into a purgatory. And Gabriel is not going to allow that to happen. So he chases them off every time that he sees them. He chases them off. So he's out to protect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gabriel seems to have a second sense, but he can also hear things that other people can't hear.
That's right. He's tuned in. He is tuned in. And you know, again, that's what we just talked about, the things that people can't understand. You know, like, well, I didn't hear anything, so nothing must have happened. Well, he heard it. So it wasn't mm-hmm. for everybody to hear. And he's protecting us, you know, whether we are conscious of that or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just think sort of as a black man, you know, off stage and on stage, but off stage too, there are these, I mean, the Gabriel is something you probably or others probably embody consciously or unconsciously as you move through, you know, through society. You know, there are things that that you notice, that we notice as black people, that other people might not notice because of the form. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, it's funny you said that, because I was speaking to a friend of mine just the other day, a Caucasian female, and mm-hmm. we're having this casual conversation, and we were talking about people being accused of crimes that they'd never committed. And I said, you know, if I had a dollar for every time I've been stopped, pulled over, detained by the police, I'd own a few houses. And she just found that completely surprising and shocking. It did not enter into her reality or her consciousness. And she was like, well, how can they do that? You know, if you didn't do anything, how can they stop you? I was like, you know, it was almost humorous in her innocence, that she genuinely couldn't understand how that could possibly conceivably happen. And I had to explain that it happens far too often, and for reasons because there are those that are racist and ignorant and judge people based on appearance alone. And it's a scourge of this world, not just the country, but of the world, because it happens in so many different places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real. So anybody who talks about a post-racial society or a community is they're uninformed. I won't say that they're, you know, foolish, but they just they don't have all the information.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Wow. Well, gosh, Michael, it's been really, really lovely speaking to you. I remember at opening night you told me that you let me know when you were going on, and you are on. That is so wonderful this week.
I wasn't sure it was going to happen, but as soon as I got the word, I was like, uh-oh, here we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so awesome. So the play continues through next weekend, the 11th, which is Mother's Day.
Right.
And I was wondering, with regards to your performances on Sunday, is there an audience conversation on either the matinee or the evening performance this weekend? Because I know sometimes
Well, they've been having the talk back to just about every performance so far, so I'm pretty
okay.
sure that there will be. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there will
be. Oh, great. So then people can talk to you about Gabriel and meet you in person. That'll be super.
Yeah. It's every show there's been a talk back, and you know, some of the actors are more selective about the ones that they're attending now. You know, it's pretty late in the run, and they're tired. So, you know, I totally get it. I'm a little fresher than they are because I've had fewer opportunities to perform, so I'm a little fresher than the rest of them are. But there will be, I'm sure there will be talk backs this coming weekend.
Super, super, excellent, excellent. And so what would you say in closing to young people about this production and why and how they can enter into the story? I mean, there are, you know, Corey is, you know, a young person, high school. He's, you know, he's in high school when we meet him. And, you know, he's certainly younger, but the period is not now. I was wondering, sort of when you're talking to young people about these historic type of plays, what would you say to them would be a reason for them to attend? And sort of what is your hope for today's audience, particularly the younger audiences? I'm thinking, you know, 21-ish kind of age or.
Well, I've had the chance this week to perform for two younger audiences, and they ate it up. I mean, they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And I think that the reason that they love it and connect to it is because, as I had mentioned earlier, August Wilson's themes are universal, and I think they transcend time and space. And so while this play takes place, you know, 50, 60 years before where we are today, the themes and topics that are covered are timeless. That they still connect. The dots still connect, and they still resonate. And I think it applies to everybody, regardless of race, class, age, ethnicity. The issues are still tangible, and I think they're accessible to everybody. And judging from the audience responses that we've had this past week, and in past productions that I've done, I've yet to meet anybody who, at any age, that said they couldn't connect. And I've had positive feedback from all ages, from, you know, 12 to 85, that people just, they found something in that they loved and connected to and that they took away with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where are you going to be appearing next after the 11th?
That's a very good question. I don't have another gig lined up as of yet. I've had several auditions for productions, and I'm waiting to hear back on those and a bunch of voiceover auditions that I've done, and but nothing in the fold as of yet, but I expect that to change relatively soon. Yeah, I'm motivated, hungry, and I will have something else very soon.
Okay, super. Well, congratulations once again, Michael, on your being able to go on as Gabriel on Sunday the 4th at 2 and 7 at the Marin Theater Company's production of August Wilson's Fences. And I know you're just having a ball because you're that kind of actor, that kind of person. yeah. And
Thank you for having me, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. And I guess because, you know, you've been attending but you haven't been on, you bring a freshness to the play at this point in the run.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting how it's it takes on a different life when I'm on stage, and because it's just when we all have to adjust. I have to adjust to them, they have to adjust to me, and I'm trying to keep it consistent with what we've done. But I've also been strongly encouraged to be who I am in the character, because we're all different, we're all individuals, and we bring different energy to what we do. So I try to do that. And you know, big props to our artistic director Jason Menzakis for having the courage to put on this show and in Mill Valley and commit to it and make it happen. So it's all good.
Yeah. They've done some really good work with August Wilson's plays. Some very good work. Yeah. And I just love the idea of, and the music, you know, the original score and the set design. It's just wonderful all around production. Very
it
all
is.
Around. Very
that
nice.
It is. And I would say that even if I wasn't in it, it is a great production.
Well, cool, super. Well, thank you again so much for joining us after, you know, a late night. I really appreciate it, and have a great weekend. I'm really sorry I'm not going to be able to catch you on Sunday, darn it. But I'll be with you in spirit.
I appreciate that, and I'll be back again soon, and we'll catch the next one.
All right, super. You take good care.
I will. Thank you again, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings. So we're speaking again to Michael J. Asbury about August Wilson's Fences on stage He's going to be on stage in the role of Gabriel this weekend, Sunday, May 4th at 2 and 7. So you don't want to miss that. It's going to really be a special, special production. And before we go out with another one of Jeremy DeCristo's works, and again, he has his the opening of his exhibition is tonight. We are going to, I want to give you another announcement about a celebration of life and struggle. Welcome home, Lynn Stewart. Lynn Stewart, Pam Africa, and Ramona Africa are going to be in town tonight. And tonight through Sunday, they're going to be in San Francisco at 6 p.m. at 518 Valencia Street, being hosted by the National Lawyers Guild. It should be really exciting. This is their initial Bay Area tour schedule. There are some other points. They're not going to actually be here Monday and Tuesday. And then on Saturday, the tour continues May 3rd in the evening in San Jose, and the host is the San Jose Peace and Justice Center and NLG South Bay. And then on Sunday, May 4th, the tour at 6 p.m., the tour is going to be at the Humanist Hall, which is at 390 27th Street in Oakland between Broadway and Telegraph. So that's really exciting. And I had a really wonderful conversation with Ramona Africa about Mumia Abu-Jamal. He just had a birthday on the 24th, and they had a really he made 60 this year, and they had a really wonderful program and symposia in Philadelphia around his work, as well as sort of the work of to free political prisoners and prisoners of war, ending mass incarceration, abolishing the death penalty, and stopping police brutality and murder. So I am going to play that interview, even though it's cut off, because, well, I'm going to play it, and but first I actually wanted to play Jeremy DeCristo's monolith. So I'm going to play Africa's monolith just because I didn't get a chance to play the Eric Dolphy one either. It's like, oh, heck. So I'm going to play Africa's monolith, and then after Ramona finishes, but I'm not certain I'm going to get to it, I might have to play that next week, the Eric Dolphy one. But I'm going to play Africa's monolith, and then I'm going to shift right into an interview with Ramona Africa, so that you can hear her talk about what's been going on with MOVE and with what's going on specifically around the MOVE 9, who have been up. Their minimum sentencing has been served, and yet they keep on being denied parole. So we're going to listen to her talk about that. So here's Africa's monolith. Ramona Africa's burn scars are not the only reminders for her of the day she fled the raging fire that killed most of her family on May 13, 1985. She was the only adult to escape the home with her life. Her anger and bitterness over that day still burn as deeply as the flames that engulfed six adults and five children inside the move house at 6221 Osage Avenue in Philadelphia. She says in an article posted May 7, 2010, philly.com, "Despite the grief and the shock, what got me through was my bitterness." Again, she recounts recently of her, not recently, but 4 years ago, of her recovery in the days following the bombing. Africa served 7 years in prison on riot charges stemming from the 1985 confrontation. She later sued the city and pocketed part of the $1.5 million civil rights judgment. In 1985, Ramona Africa, who was then and still is the spokeswoman for MOVE, was often seen in front of the Osage home yelling into a bullhorn, calling for the release of the MOVE members, nine of them, who were convicted of killing a police officer during a shootout between the police and members in 1978. So this is what we're going to be talking about today with Ramona in a pre-recorded interview. She actually, she and Pam Africa are in the air right now headed for the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have a program tonight hosted by the Lawyers Guild, the San Francisco National Lawyers Guild. And again, that program is at 518 Valencia Street in San Francisco, and that's at 6 p.m. So they're literally going to be touching down and heading over to the venue, and that's just one of three stops in the San Francisco Bay Area this weekend. Tomorrow, again, is in San Jose, and Sunday is in Oakland, and it is it's a celebration of life and struggle and a welcome home to Lynn Stewart, attorney, who was incarcerated for many years and who is now released. So it's definitely a cause of celebration, as well as a renewal of our struggle in opposition to to the unjust incarceration and continued arrest and incarceration of people whose views do not sit well with this United States government. So I'm going to play this wonderful interview I had with Ramona last night as she was packing, getting ready to get on the plane this morning, which she and Pam Africa are on right now en route from Philadelphia to San Francisco. So here is the interview, and you'll hear her packing in the middle of the conversation, and you'll hear sort of the rustling. And I want to encourage people to visit the website onamove.com, onamove.com. And Ramona's going to give you information about how to support the release of the MOVE 9, who to write to call for their release, because they've served the minimum sentencing, and there's no reason why, since they've been found suitable, why they have not been released, except that, this government has sort of an inconsistent way of applying justice and the legal statutes that are very inconsistent, but not unexpected. So here's Ramona Africa, and thank you again so much for tuning in to another edition of Wanda's Picks. Peace and blessings. Yeah, when I saw your email in April, I thought you were coming in April, but then my friend told me that I had misread it, and then I looked at it again. It's like, oh man, I missed the.
We were out there a couple weeks ago.
But
we planned on coming back. Jeff Mackler is bringing us out.
Mm-hmm.
you know, for the Lynn Stewart Momia activities.
Right, yeah, you have a whole lot of great things, you know, planned. Like, as soon as you touch down, you know, first day, you know, you're in the air and then on the ground. All the way through Monday, I believe, right?
Sexy, yeah, it's been that way since we came out there, because last time we came out there a couple weeks ago, we got off the plane and went right to UC Berkeley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know. Yeah. When we say on the move, that's what we mean.
You know, that is so true. That is so true. It's not just a euphemism. You really are on the move.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so bring us up to speed on what's been going on, you know. I mean, I saw Lynn Stewart in February when I was in New Jersey for Imamu Amiri Baraka's home.
Oh, yeah.
And they had that, you know, the great dinner for the political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Right.
You know, that that same day. So we went over there, Robert King and I, and that was really wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
well, there's been a lot going on. You know, we've had a 3-day celebration of life program for Momia.
Mm-hmm.
And that went great. We had a wonderful dinner on Thursday, April 24th, which is Momia's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a message, videotape message from Ras Baraka, Amiri and Amina Baraka's son.
Yes.
And we also had a videotape message from Angela Davis.
Mm-hmm.
We had Professor Cornell West there.
Mm.
He spoke in person. He came to the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Abby O'Dune of The Last Poets.
Nice.
Was there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a great, great evening. Good food, good people, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just great. And we raised funds for Mumia's War Chest. So it was just a very, very warm family vibe. You know, a really good evening. And then on Saturday, that was the major program. There was a rally and march from 19th and Cecil B. Moore Avenue in North Philadelphia. That was the original Philadelphia Black Panther Party headquarters and the home of Captain Reggie Shell of the Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And people rallied there and marched from there, from 19th and Cecil B. Moore, to the Church of the Advocate. And that's at 18th and Diamond. Once there, there was all kinds of activity. There were activities for the children, face painting and various activities. There were vendors, food vendors, vendors of clothing, T-shirts, jewelry, just books and, you know, all kinds of vendors, which was great. There was entertainers, Immortal Technique, M1 of Dead Prez, and just a huge number of other entertainers that, you know, skip my mind right now, but it was great. Taina Asili, who is a Latino woman who has a beautiful voice and a beautiful, you know, band that she works with. It was just great. There were workshops on political prisoners, the intimidation of lawyers, you know, who dare to step up for their clients. There was a workshop on the media, you know. It was just so much information put out for people, you know, entertainment. It was just great. For all ages, Wanda. For all ages.
Yeah, it sounds really wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard of anything quite like this on Mumia's birthday before. This sounds
right. Well, it was his 60th birthday, which is a
significant
milestone.
Yeah.
You know, so we wanted to do it big to call people's attention to it, you know.
Yeah. What year is this for him?
He was arrested in 81, so it's 33 years.
Oh my
this year.
Wow. Yeah. And so you said funds were raised for his war chest. So what's going on with his case now? He's in general population, but he's still not out. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, right now, you know, we don't really ever like to cause any dissension or division, but we have had issues with the attorneys for Mumia, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, because when Obama nominated Debo Adebili for the Justice Department, and the Fraternal Order of Police went crazy and misused Mumia's case, saying that Adebili, you know, supported Mumia, represented him, and, you know, that whole bit, and used that to denounce Debo Adebili and say that there is no way that he should be, you know, in the U.S. Justice Department. And they just blatantly lied on me. I mean, they just recycled these 32-year-old lies, 33 years at this point,
right,
you know, lies that have been disputed
right
for the past 33 years. And the Legal Defense Fund, who supposedly represents Mumia, didn't say a word. I mean, they did not come to Mumia's defense to dispute these lies. They just let them stand. And we had a meeting with them. You know, Mumia's supporters had a meeting with them saying, what is your problem? How can you allow these lies, you know, to just stand like that without putting the truth out there to dispute these lies? And they were saying really ridiculous things like, well, our arena is in the courtroom, and, you know, like they don't do anything else, which is a lie, because they put out several lukewarm milquetoast statements in support of Debo Adebili, but they did that. That wasn't in the courtroom, you know? So they were just making excuses, and we were like, no, this is not acceptable at all, you know? So we have a problem with them. And, you know, I don't know what else to say except that they are not really representing Mumia. We cannot fire them. People have been making Mumia aware of the issues that people have with them because they did not come to his defense. And, you know, whether or not to fire them is up to Mumia. But they have not even come up with any, you know, legal arguments to get Mumia back in court. And we're not saying that that is an easy task, because the only way Mumia can get back into court is if they can discover new evidence that wasn't available, could not have been discovered before. And, you know, that's a hard task right there, and we understand that. But our position is, even if you can't get him back into court right now and you keep looking for ways to do that, how do you sit back and allow the Fraternal Order of Police to just put these lies out there? How do you do that? So, you know, that's where we're at with Mumia's case and these attorneys, the legal defense fund. So that's where we're at on that.
Okay.
At the same time, we are engaged in a battle for the Move 9 on this parole issue. And that's a serious battle right there, because the parole board, as you know, just keeps refusing to parole the Move 9, any of them. And they keep saying because they won't take responsibility for their crimes on August 8th of 78. And we're saying, what crimes? They've been telling the parole board and anybody else that will listen for the past, going on 36 years now, that they did not commit a crime. The judge on the case, Edward Malmet, who heard their case without a jury and was the person solely responsible for the determination of innocence or guilt, at the end of the trial, he convicted the Move 9, but then went on a radio program and said he did not have the faintest idea who killed Officer James Ram. Now, that is just ridiculous, because whether it's a judge or a jury, they are supposed to be certain beyond a reasonable doubt if they convict somebody. Now, Judge Malmet sat up there and said he didn't have the faintest idea. So where does that leave reasonable doubt? Sounds like he had plenty of doubt. He didn't have the faintest idea, you know, who killed that cop. So, you know, for the parole board to demand that Move people lie and say that they committed a crime that they didn't is absolutely ridiculous, you know? And we're not going to sit by quietly and accept it. So we're battling the parole board. We have people writing the parole board, calling the parole board, demanding that Move people be released. You know, when you add to the issue that the very judge who sat on the case said that he didn't have the faintest idea of who killed that cop, when you add to that the fact that Move people have done their entire sentence in jail, people like me, my sister Sue Africa, my sister Alberta Africa, Mo Africa, you know, we did our entire sentence. And we were released in the 90s, early 90s. And not one of us has been back to jail. Not one of us has been arrested for anything, you know. Carlos and Consuela Africa were paroled in the early 90s and completed their parole and have never been arrested again. So, you know, what is their problem in paroling Move people? Obviously, when Move people come out here, we're not likely candidates to be, you know, rearrested. You know, they always talk about recidivism.
Right.
You know, obviously Move people are not candidates for, you know, recidivism, of going back. So why do they have so much trouble paroling Move people? The prisons that my family is in recommend Move people for parole. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fight we're engaged in now. And one thing that we're going to be doing is we're going to approach organizations of attorneys,
mm-hmm.
like the National Lawyers Guild, like the barristers, and any other organizations that, you know, we can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to request that they go into the case of the Move 9 on two issues only. They don't have to go past two issues, Wanda. The first one being the destruction of Move headquarters. You know, basically before my family was even processed on charges in August of 78, and how once the evidence was destroyed, once the scene of the crime, Move headquarters, was demolished, that they should not have been able to proceed with the trial at that point. They deliberately destroyed vital evidence, the scene of the crime. The second issue that we're going to request that they review and look into is the fact that the trial judge, you know, who sat on that case without a jury and, you know, who was supposed to be paying close attention and making a just verdict, convicted our family, gave them 30 to 100 year sentences each, and then said he didn't have the faintest idea who killed that cop. How can a conviction like that stand? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So those two issues we're going to be requesting that, you know, organizations like the barristers and the National Lawyers Guild and any other organizations of attorneys that we, you know, can get to review this and look into this and then issue a report on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do that as well.
Yeah.
Also, the district attorney here in Philadelphia, Seth Williams, the first black district attorney, he has said, and it's only words at this point, that he is creating a unit in the district attorney's office to review questionable cases, cases where there could be prosecutorial misconduct, judicial misconduct, you know, where innocent people could be in prison. And we're saying we know 10 of them right off the bat, the Move 9 and Mumia. You know, so we're going to be pressuring him, you know, to have this new unit to review the case of the Move 9 and Mumia. So that's, you know, what we're involved in now. That's what we're working on, as well as traveling and you know, activities that we have been involved in for decades and continue to be involved in. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're definitely on the move.
Certainly. So Friday when you arrive tomorrow, you're going to be in San Francisco Friday, May 2nd, 6 p.m. At 518 Valencia Street, and you're being hosted by the National Lawyers Guild.
Right.
And you mentioned, you know, just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
That, yeah. So, are you in conversation with them, or are you going to present this proposal to them?
No, we're not in conversation with them right now. But in fact, I want to present, you know, to the National Lawyers Guild chapter here in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that are close and can review it. If, you know, organizations across the country, National Lawyers Guild chapters across the country want to be involved in this, that's great. Obviously, we're not going to say no, we don't want you to do that. But we just want to focus on people that are right here and would have easy access, you know, to records, to information, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when I said the National Lawyers Guild, I was speaking more so in Philadelphia. And we have been working with Heidi Boghossian out of New York, who is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. You know, and she's in New York, and she's familiar with our case. So we have, you know, been in regular contact with her and have worked with her. So I don't perceive this being a difficult project to get these organizations involved in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be something that they should be ready and willing,
mm-hmm.
you know, to delve into, because it's so clear. I mean, how much clearer can you get when evidence, vital evidence, the scene of the crime was destroyed on the day of the arrest before MOVE people were even processed by order of the city of Philadelphia. And I should also say this was done despite the fact that a judge named Calvin Wilson, a black judge, had issued a court order that nothing was to be done with that house before they had a hearing on a permanent injunction from, you know, doing anything on that house. This was even before it became a crime scene, before it became vital evidence. There was a court order in play, you know, forbidding anybody, city officials, whoever, anybody, from doing anything to that house. It became a crime scene where a cop was killed, and they ignore that order and go right on in and demolish it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. just those issues alone, the destruction of the house, and Judge Malman saying he doesn't know, doesn't have the faintest idea who killed those cops. I mean, you can't get past that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that film, the recent film, I think it came
Let
out.
Let the Fire Burn.
Yeah, it was like so clear. I mean, they're on record. And then just reflecting on it, the people that were there, you know, saying, well, the order was don't touch it. And then I don't remember who it was that said it didn't matter. You know, I want you to, you know, bomb it anyway or set the fire anyway. Yeah, it's
yeah,
just disregard for you know, these judicial steps and mandates, you know, the legal mandates, you know,
yeah.
not having respect for them yet expecting other people to have respect.
But see, this is what MOVE have been telling people for close to 40 years now,
mm-hmm.
that these people don't care. They don't give a darn about no legality. They want to shove it down people's throats, down our throat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and demand that we